We are continuing our study, the world of the New Testament. Hopefully one of the byproducts of this emphasis is that whenever you see something, read something, hear something about the ancient world, you'll see how that it aligns, it harmonizes so well with the biblical information, which is confirmation, not absolute convincing evidence, but it is confirmation of the legitimate record of the New Testament. Because there are a lot of people who think that it's not, and it's because they haven't looked at it. That's why they think that way. So a lot of benefits to this. So glad you could be here with us tonight. Ray, could you lead us in a prayer as we begin?
Dear Lord, thank you that you are our God and that we can join together in this place. And it's because of you, Father, because we worship you and praise you. And we thank you for your Son and the revelation from your Word. And now as we study it tonight, pray that you're with us and among us and help us to learn, help our teacher to be effective in the things he teaches. And help us, Father, as a result of this, to know more about you, understand you more, to be more faithful and better equipped to handle the world that we're in and around. And thank you for the teaching of your Son, Jesus, as we focus on that tonight. And help us to see it in a new way and the information as Philip presents it to us. And bless us in that effort. And thank you for the forgiveness of our sins. And thank you for your Son, Jesus. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.
We've talked about how that the background of the New Testament is about three worlds colliding. What are those three worlds or spheres?
Roman
rule, Jewish society, and Greek culture all colliding. And so we've been talking about the Greeks, and we're going to keep talking about the Greeks tonight and then introduce the Romans. So I want you to start with me in Joel, over in the Old Testament, the minor prophet Joel, in chapter 3. Now you may be wondering, okay, if we're going to keep talking about the Greeks, why are we going to a Hebrew prophet? Well, this Hebrew prophet mentions the Greeks. It's about the only reference in the Old Testament to them. Joel is writing about the Israelites suffering because of their sins, but the prophets also spoke to the nations. And sometimes those prophets would condemn what those nations were doing, even though the Israelites were experiencing consequences that they deserved. And this is one of those cases. Look in Joel chapter 3, verses 4 to 6. Les, can you read that for us? Joel 3, 4 through 6.
Indeed, what have you to do with me, O Tyre and Sidon, and all the coast of Cilicia? Will you retaliate against me? But if you retaliate against me swiftly and speedily, I will return your retaliation upon your own head. Because you have taken my silver and my gold and have carried into your temples my prized possessions. How far did you want me to go?
Through six, 4 to 6.
Also the people of Judah and the people of Jerusalem, you have sold to the Greeks that you may remove them far from their borders.
All right, thank you. He's addressing the people of Tyre and Sidon, and it says right here in this text, where do the people of Tyre and Sidon live? Geographically, where do they live?
On the coast.
On the coast. Which meant they're likely familiar with doing a lot of what? Trade. And trade via what means? That's right, on the seas. Tyre and Sidon were the chief cities of the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians in early ancient history were the maritime commercial traders. They dominated the Mediterranean, their shipping, their movement of goods. And here they are condemned because in addition to precious metals, they had also traded in what?
People.
What people?
Jewish
people. That's right, people of Judah and Jerusalem. So we know that in that divided kingdom period, there were a lot of raids by other nations, even besides Assyria and Babylon toward the end. And so somehow or the other, people of Tyre and Sidon had traded in Israelite slaves, and they sold them to whom? Greeks. So that tells us something about the Greeks. The Greeks were involved in what?
Slavery.
Boy, they had a lot of slaves in Greece. A lot of slaves. What else? To get those slaves, what did they do? Traded. Traded how? Over what means?
Maritime.
Maritime trade again. That's exactly right. And remember, one of the things we talked about regarding the Greeks is that their land restricted them. In what way? What were the land restrictions we talked about last time with the Greeks? So many mountains, such rough terrain, that little of the land was left to farm. So, if your population gets pretty good size, you've got to go elsewhere to get stuff. Sort of like Japan and Britain in modern times. And so, the Greeks, same way there. So, this is sort of where we left off last time. And I want you to think about the Greek culture and the backdrop to the New Testament here a little bit. For instance, we looked at these passages, and I'd like for you to just turn to these passages. We looked at them more closely last time, but let me ask you a few questions about the Greeks and the New Testament in light of this. First of all, according to Romans chapter 1, verse 16, what place in God's plan did the Greeks have? God's plan through Christ. What place did they have?
Language?
Well, their language is going to be very important. According to Romans 1:16, in God's plan of salvation, what role did they have? What position?
Equal to the Jew.
They can have the gospel. They can be saved by the power of the gospel, just like the Jews and also the Greeks. However, that term Greek there is an inclusive statement. Does this mean you think only the people who lived on the mainland in the Isles of Greece? It says to the Jews first and also to the Greeks. Who is that really talking about?
Gentiles.
Everybody who's not a Jew is Gentiles. Why would the term Greek be used at this point to describe all the Gentiles?
So broadening the culture at the time.
Because almost everyone who's not a Jew, to some extent, had embraced the Greek culture. It would be hard to find someone in the first, second century BC and the first century AD who was not in an area where there was movement of people and goods. It would be hard to find anybody around the Mediterranean that did not speak Greek. It'd be really hard to do that. So, Greek really stands for the Gentile world. And according to Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 20, 32 in there, what were they like? What were the Greeks like? Now, this is a general Gentile description, but wow, when you look at the context of Romans, this really is aimed at the Greeks. What was their condition according to Romans 1, 18 down to the end of the chapter? They were unrighteous, and that unrighteousness and immorality stemmed from what?
Idolatry,
because they failed to recognize the one true God. And let's look at some characteristics. What do you remember from 1 Corinthians chapter 1? We've studied that in class recently. We talked about this last week in this study. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, what do the Greeks value? Wisdom. And in that context, it's the idea of human reasoning in human speech to communicate that wisdom. It's not wisdom like you have elevated in the Old Testament, like in the book of Proverbs. It's the idea of human reasoning and so forth. There's the incident in Acts chapter 14 where Paul and Barnabas are preaching in Antioch of Pisidia. And when they see them do a miracle, they think that Paul and Barnabas are who? They're gods, they're Greek gods. There's Zeus and what was the other one mentioned? Forgot. Hermes. Yeah, okay. They think they're Greek gods. So what does that tell you? The Greeks were very superstitious. They were very much committed to these myths. And you may think, well, this is only among the lower classes. Yeah, it was especially true of the lower classes, but also the middle and the upper classes. They didn't have a lot of middle classes. And in Acts chapter 17, if Acts 14 is talking about the masses, Acts 17 is not. It's talking about the elite of the Areopagus in Athens. And what does the text say about those folks which led them to invite Paul to speak? What did the Athenians love to do? Investigate some new idea, some new philosophy. What's the listen? That is the definition of an academic. The academic is like, okay, give me a new theory. Give me a new theory as to why that happened. Give me a new theory about this or that. Give me some new idea. Academic journals are built on that. And even if there's no evidence, they still want people to come up with something. Okay, stretch it if necessary. And this is the sermon where Paul talks about that they worship the one true God in ignorance, and he's trying to explain to them about the one true God. And so this tells us a lot about the Greeks. They really emphasize human reasoning, those last three passages. They emphasize human reasoning. They're very still driven by superstition regarding their gods, and they loved debate and investigation, discussion, which gave Paul an audience there with them. We quickly talked about early Greece, some of the characteristics, and some of these things are true of Greece, period, because mountainous, that's geographic, and these are some of the things we looked at. And then that last point, they're seagoing peoples, and they're heavy involved in trade, and they're colonizing across the Mediterranean region, which is another reason why, by the time you get to New Testament times, you've got so many people speaking Greek. There's two reasons why. This is not the biggest reason, but this is a reason. Greeks had colonized across the Mediterranean. There were Greek communities all across the Mediterranean, including as far away as, you know, Italy and Spain and so forth. And so no wonder Joel says Greeks bought Israelite slaves off the Phoenicians, because the Greeks are heavily involved in maritime trade and trading of goods and so forth, because they had to do that. This is where we left off last time, and so we're going to talk about these three stages of Greek history, and watch how this takes us right to the New Testament. Watch how it connects to the New Testament. So, if you've not got your package, you can jump up and get those, but those are there. The ones on the left are from last week, the ones on the right from for this week. So let's talk about this real quickly. This is a rough three-stage development. There are exceptions to this. But what we call classical Greece is what people think of when they think of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. I have to always pause when I say Plato because I want to say Pluto. You know, Pluto and Daffy Duck, they were great Greek philosophers. But this is that classic age where civilizations after the Greeks really cherish what happened in this age. This is where the city-states were in really strong competition with each other. And you've heard about the big competition between Athens and Sparta. And by the way, guess who's sort of right between Athens and Sparta? Corinth. Corinth was involved in this too, this competition between city-states. But what happens is, even though they're separated by these mountains, there's a lot of trade that starts to happen, and especially along the coastline. And over time in the classical period, you begin to see a Greek culture that takes shape. And by culture, we're talking about their literature, like the writings of Homer, the belief in the various gods that they had concocted. And they have extensive mythology associated with these gods. So creative it was that even to this day, it's studied by people and they're fascinated with it. The architecture is very impressive. You want to see a good example of Greek architecture, visit Washington, D.C., what you call neoclassical. It's sort of Greco-Roman, but it's heavily Greece. And then, of course, the philosophies and the language. You begin to see a language coalesce across these city-states. It's similar. Then here's what happens. We talked about some of this real quickly on the timeline. But Macedonia is north of Greece. We've studied about that recently with the Corinthian class. Remember the Macedonians whose gift was ready? Well, they had a king named Philip. And he was very successful, very driven. He's sort of a blue-collar kind of guy. He's not very sophisticated and polished, but he's a great administrator and a mighty warrior. And so he actually descends. He builds a mighty Macedonian army, and he conquers the Greeks. But he adopts their culture, like pretty much everybody else that encounters the Greeks. For about a 400-year period, they adopt their culture. His son, Alexander, is given the best education that can be given. Aristotle was one of his tutors. And Alexander is assassinated. Even to this day, it's quite disputed why he was assassinated, but he's assassinated. His son eventually ends up in the position of the king of the Macedonians, which means he's now also the king of the Greeks. This is the first time under Philip and Alexander that the Greeks have a unified political system. Before this, they were very splintered. But now they're becoming unified under these rulers. Even they didn't ask for it. Alexander begins a couple years into his reign, one of the most extensive, swiftest, and most efficient series of conquests ever in human history. And if you notice, I left something out. Most of the time when people talk about Alexander, they call him what? The Great. You noticed that, didn't you? Okay. I left that out. Why? I just wanted to. We don't have to call him the Great. It's okay. I mean, we call Cyrus the Great. That's okay. But I just thought I'd leave it out this time. Because we're putting this against the backdrop of the New Testament, and we know who's the Great. We know who the great king is. And I'm not going to throw another book, but there's no comparison. Okay? So he conquers across the waters there to Asia Minor. We know it's Turkey today. Sometimes it's called Anatolia. And that was a heavily Greek area, by the way. But it's that area that Paul visited a couple centuries later in his missionary journeys, like Derbe and Lystra and Iconia, and where Ephesus is and Colossae is and all those places. So he just wipes through there. Then he encounters the Persians, defeats them in a big battle, descends down into Palestine, conquers Egypt, goes back up toward Persia, beats them again in a big battle, really lays it on them in another big battle. He conquers the Persians. And then he actually conquers all the way over to basically the borders of India. And he could have kept going, but his men were like, we're tired of this. So they head back. He dies in Babylon. He dies at a very young age, at 32, in 323 BC. And hard to know exactly what he died from, all these theories, alcoholism, VD, whatever. He got a fever and died, okay? And when he dies, there's a lot of dispute about, you know, who's going to rule now and those kinds of things. Let's see, I'm going without my notes. Let me look here. So here's what happens when he dies. He's 32. He is just at the front end of a dynasty. There's not an established way of handing over the reins to someone else. And he dies at 32. He's not writing a will yet at 32. Who has a will at 32? I've got one now, but I didn't have one at 32. He dies. And so that leaves things in a little bit of disarray. That takes us into what is called the Hellenistic period. Now, why is this called the Hellenistic period? Actually, it's the Romans who come along later, and because they're so influential, what they sort of do sticks. The Romans like to call the Greeks Greek. It's the Romans who really dub them the Greeks. Early Greeks refer to themselves as the Hellenists. That was really their word for themselves. And so this next period, historians have actually applied that term, the Hellenistic period. But whenever you see the term Hellenistic or Hellens, and you do see that in the New Testament, think Greek. That's what it means. It's synonymous with Greek. What happened was Alexander was so in love with Greek culture, the philosophy, the agriculture, the language, and everything else, which none of that was his native culture, but he had adopted it. He plants it everywhere he goes. That's why in a big swath of the world at that time, you have all these cities called Alexandria. And the one that endures is Alexandria, Egypt, which was a center of Greek learning, matter of fact, which is where the 70 Jewish scholars make a translation of the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures into Greek that we call the Septuagint, around 200 BC. But Alexander promoted and he planted Greek culture, the architecture, the literature, the philosophy, the language, wherever he went, and it really stuck. And what you have now is Greek culture in lands very different than the Greek homeland. And wherever you go, this happens. Hellenistic culture is a little different in Persia than it was in Egypt, than it was in India. And yes, it reached all the way to India. To give you an idea of the extent of Hellenistic influence after Alexander's conquest, because Greek administrations were set up in many of these lands. This is an image of a Buddha, the Buddha, okay, who was that philosopher that emerges around this time, by the way. This is an Indian Buddha, and all of us have seen images of Buddha like this. And this is a Chinese Buddha. And they're a little different, okay? They tend to be skinnier in India and a little fatter in China, by the way. They also tend to be a little happier in China. I don't understand that. But archaeologists have also uncovered Buddhas in India that look like this. This is considered a Greek-influenced Buddha. Do you see the garb? And to the right there is a typical Greek statue. You know, the short haircut, the like toga-like garment, the very humanistic figure. See, the Buddha and the other figures, the Buddha is unrealistic. It's not like a human, and the Buddha was a human, okay? It's very non-realistic. Greek sculpturing was very realistic. It looked like the way people are. And look at this Buddha. All the way to India, Greek culture was influencing people, even when they sculptured Buddhas. They were doing it in Greek style. So that gives you an idea how pervasive this culture is. So we talked last week about how people in the New Testament, the Jews and then Christians, are going to have to really battle Greek culture. And there's a lesson for us, because we're going to have to battle our culture too. And this shows you how pervasive that culture is. It's as pervasive across the Mediterranean, through the Middle East, parts of Africa, North Africa, and into South Central Asia as American culture is today in Europe and in Asia and in Africa. American culture is everywhere. It's everywhere. So that's what's happening here. So let's talk here a little bit about what happens after Alexander's death, because this is going to have a play up on the Jews and what's happening between the Testaments. When he dies at such a young age, there's no clear line of succession, because his father had set up an authoritarian monarchical system, especially back in Macedonia and Greece. And what happens is that, typical, there's a power play, and several of his generals are vying for control, and basically they just stake out their territory. And there's about, depending on when you count it, there's about 4 to 5 different generals that claim jurisdiction over different areas that Alexander had conquered. Some back in Greece, some in Egypt, some, you know, over in what we know as Persia today. The two that are relevant to biblical times has to do with the Seleucids that rule here in this Persian area in old Babylon, and the Ptolemies that rule here in Egypt. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Because when the Jews go back after Babylonian captivity, the Persians let them come back here. They've been rolling along there, struggling, but rolling along there for a couple of centuries. And then Alexander comes through. He cuts through Palestine or Judea. And then he's gone with a puff of the wind. But these two kingdoms, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, rule there for many, many years. And what happens is that Judea becomes a football that is just kicked back and forth between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And at times they're quite tolerant of the Jews, at other times they're not. Including Antiochus Epiphanes, and this is good evidence that this is previewed in the book of Daniel. Antiochus Epiphanes had come down here and lost a battle in Egypt, and when he goes back, he's ticked off and he stops in Jerusalem and he lets them have it. He just basically sacks Jerusalem, and he's the one that sets up a Greek idol in the temple. He has his men to roast a pig on the altar at the temple. And how do you think that went over with the Jews? So there's going to be a dual reaction to these Greeks. Some Jews will cower before these Greeks and sort of like cave in or accommodate themselves to the Greeks because the Greeks are so powerful. Others will be defiant. And they'll fight physically. And they'll fight in other ways. We'll get to this in the coming days. This helps to create the Pharisees who want to be separate. And they don't want any Greek influence. So that's what happens there with Alexander's empire. So here's a map that will help you a little bit with what's happening. And I want you to think in terms of what's going to happen in the New Testament in the first century. So C stands for Greek colonies. The Greek colonies are over here in this Asia Minor area. Okay, this is a heavily Greek area. Heavily Greek area. And remember who goes there and preaches? Paul does. And Barnabas and Silas and others. Timothy. And there are Greek colonies over here in the Italian peninsula as well as Sicily and other places in the Western Mediterranean. So the Romans, early Romans, were very familiar with Greek ways because they interacted with Greeks in these colonies. And then we have Alexander's conquest. I've got P and A there, P for Philip and A for Alexander. Philip leads the invasion of Greece. He's assassinated, but Alexander sort of finishes the job in Greece and gets everything under his control. And then he goes on a tear. And he goes over here to Asia Minor, conquers there, he defeats the Persians there in the upper Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. He conquers Judea, he conquers Egypt. He doesn't do a whole lot of negative things in Judea. And then he defeats the Persians again, and then I've got an arrow because he's off the map. Alexander is off the map. He conquers all the way to the gates of India. And what we know today is Iraq and Iran and even Pakistan. He's over in that general territory, conquering. And then he comes back. And wherever he has conquered, and because of other expansion of the Greeks, even earlier expansion because of the colonies, Hellenistic culture or Greek culture, the philosophies, the Greek gods, the literature, the language, the architecture, especially the language. If you want to be anybody, you had to learn Greek. For about a 300-year period, you had to learn Greek. Like today, in the world, if you want to do international business, if you want to be, you know, an international scholar, what language must you learn? English. Exactly right. So if you want to be somebody commercially or academically or politically and cross borders, you got to know Greek. It bound the world together. So Hellenistic culture, H for Hellenistic or Greek culture, is planted everywhere, including, as we saw in the statue of Buddha, all the way to India. Oddly enough, Hellenistic culture did not penetrate deep into Central and Northern Europe, or Middle and Northern Europe. The Romans will, but the Greek culture does not. Matter of fact, the Greeks called those people what, you know? Barbarians. And what that just means is barbar. It's like we say yada yada, blah, blah, blah. The Greeks would say, I don't know what they're saying. They're just saying bar, bar, bar. I don't understand their language. And it was an expression that was attached to people up in Central and Northern Europe. Those were the barbar people. We don't understand them. They didn't learn Greek, you see. The barbarians. That's a lot of our ancestors, you see. So sometimes you're the bat, sometimes you're the ball. Europeans will become the bat, but now they're the ball. All right. Okay. A lot of straight information in this class at times, especially early on, not so much later. Let me pause there since you've got any questions or observations about the spread of Greek culture, some of its New Testament connections, biblical connections. Yeah, Wes?
Well, it seems like there's a kind of a parallel. You can verify this or not, but with the Enlightenment of, you know, the late 1700s and the thinking of the was going away from revelation and more towards reasoning, rationality. Humans can figure out everything by themselves. They don't need God to tell them something, you know, so that there's kind of an intellectual movement, so that and it continues. And I think you made a comment, maybe it was last time, about Darwinism fit the bill, not because there was any evidence for it, but because it was part of the it fit nicely with the more humanistic ideology that was becoming more and more popular throughout Europe. And so that seems to have some parallels to Greek philosophical, you know, and sort of the intellectual, the wise in their way of looking at it. They were very interested in that kind of thing, just as they were in the Enlightenment period, the Age of Reason.
Right.
You know, was the same, very similar, and the consequences or the results of that, we still see it today. Yeah. I mean, from the 1600s, 1700s, all the way to now, there's still that very heavy influence of humanism, really, away from revelation from God. And we see it in our country now very heavily, I think.
Yeah, it's like Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Those are very similar. And really, it backs up to the Renaissance. Because the Renaissance, which emerges around 1500, mainly in southern Europe, but it goes northward, was actually a return to an interest in the Greeks and the Romans. The essence of the Renaissance is not so much the painting of Michelangelo. It's really the idea of we've been locked into this idea that truth is found in the church, Roman Catholic Church. What about those Greeks and Romans? They were something else, right? Well, see, the Roman Catholic Church had actually buried, in a way, Greek and Roman literature. And there is a resurgence of interest in the Greeks and the Romans, a neoclassical interest, okay, interest in the classics. That eventually will result in the Enlightenment, which at the core of the Enlightenment, you described it really well, is the emphasis on humans learning truth and gaining knowledge through their own reasoning, which was a big thing with the Greeks. Big thing with the Greeks. I mean, the Greeks didn't look to the gods to teach them anything. They just looked to the gods to push the gods' buttons and pull the gods' levers to get the gods to do things for them. But for the gods to enlighten them on how to live, the Greeks didn't look to the gods to do that. We're about to talk about that. And so the Greeks said humans have to figure that out on their own. And so the Enlightenment was an interest in that. And we live in a culture that is based on Enlightenment philosophy. Yeah. So the more things change. Okay. So some notable characteristics of Greek culture. Good segue right into this. First of all, you got to clean the slate when it comes to religion. We are so, connecting what we're just saying, we are so conditioned to think morality and religion go together. We should. That's biblical. But that's not the way the ancients thought about it, especially the Greeks. Religion and morality not paired. You didn't get your morality from what God you worship or what gods you worship. Nobody worshiped one among the Greeks. They're not connected. And philosophers were the ones that were the most revered, who you look to for morality, for life, philosophy, for guidance and direction. Now think about our study of on 1 Corinthians. Remember how those Corinthians rallied around, you know, either Peter or Paul or Apollos? They were used to that idea of celebrating some sophist, which was a rhetoric, espousing person who gave you wisdom in their speeches. And that goes way back with the Greeks. The philosophers show me how to live. And so you can see that being a very practical problem in Corinth. There's an emphasis on human reasoning. We've already talked about that, made that point right there. But at the same time, watch this. While they so emphasize human reasoning, they still had this heavy reliance on myth and superstition, which we saw in Acts 14 with how they wanted to elevate Paul and Barnabas as gods when they saw them do a miracle. So you would think those two things don't go together, right? You're an enlightened person that you relish in human reasoning, but you still believe in all these superstitions about these gods. And modern people are any different than that? I mean, look at the science fiction and the superhero movies and the witchcraft and all that stuff that flourishes in our society. Superstition is alive and well in Western society, in American society, even though we pride ourselves on science and technology. Again, the more they changed, the more they stayed the same. So it's this kind of culture that the gospel is planted in. And the gospel is going to be in contrast to that culture. And the gospel will have to do battle with that culture. And so that's, when you understand that right there, it helps. And when you read the book of Acts, a little less than the Gospels, but it helps there too. It really helps when you study the book of Acts and the letters. Books like Colossians, 1 John are letters where there is major battling going on between the gospel and Greek ideas. So there is that clash between the gospel and Greek culture. Okay, anything else? So, you could say that Greek culture came to dominate the Mediterranean world as well as outlying areas. It did. The broader Mediterranean region really was a Greek world, so to speak, for centuries leading up to the New Testament. But by the time you get the New Testament, though Greek culture was pervasive, they weren't the sheriff. The Greeks were not the sheriff. They were not running the show. The Romans were. And boy, did they run the show. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Romans, and we'll finish this next time. But we're into this phase now of looking at the Roman rule. So the Greeks provided a cultural backdrop, but the Romans provided the framework of the political authoritarian, government system. So I want you to think about Christ and the backdrop to Christ, the Christ story in the gospel. So I want you to go to the beginning. And we've hit this a couple of times, or once before, but I want you to go back there with me. Luke chapter 2. Can you read Luke chapter 2 for us, Olivia? Luke chapter 2, verse 1. Not the whole chapter, verse 1.
And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered.
All right. All the world is an accommodative expression used by Luke. This had nothing to do with China. Chinese weren't affected by this. But when Luke is writing about the world, he's writing about the Mediterranean world, He's writing about the Roman world. And here's Augustus, who spent some time in Rome, not all the time. He issues a decree about a census, and here's a little town in Bethlehem who's affected by that. And these two obscure peasants from Nazareth, Joseph and Mary. So at the beginning of Jesus' time on earth, you have a reference to the Caesar. And then, now read chapter 3, verse 1, Olivia. This is the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry, which is just right at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry. Right ahead of it.
Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene.
You're welcome. So, right at the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry and Jesus' ministry, another reference to the Caesar. But Augustus had died in 14 AD, now it's Tiberius. But a reference to the Caesar. And then there's during the ministry of Jesus. In Luke chapter 20, just glance over there. What incident does this describe? Luke 20, verses 21 to 25. You can glance at it. Your Bible may have a heading for that paragraph. What incident is this? What's Jesus asked about?
Paying taxes.
Paying taxes. And what's his answer? He says, bring me something. What? Denarius. Okay. Which is that coin I had at the beginning of the title slide. Okay. Notice it next time. And it's one with Tiberius' image, which would have been the exact same one that Jesus would have been handed. And what does Jesus say about taxes?
Render to Caesar what is Caesar's.
That's right. Render to God things that are God's, and to Caesar things that are Caesar's. In other words, yeah, give him the tax. That was a big question for Jews in Jesus' day. Remember, you have the accommodators to the outside powers, and you have the defiers. And in Jesus' day, you had those who were cooperating with the Romans, and you have those who are trying to defy the Romans. And they're trying to get Jesus in trouble with one or the other group. Do you see that? Either the pro-Romans or the anti-Romans. They're trying to get him in trouble with them. And then at the end of Jesus' life, this is in John's Gospel in the 19th chapter, things are at a fever pitch and Pilate is trying to find a way to weasel out of this and release Jesus. But look at John 19, verses 12 to 16. Ken, can you read that? John 19, 12 to 16.
From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar."
So when Pilate... Stop right there. I'm going to stop right there because it's not. Thank you. Do you see that right there? Do you see what comes into play on the day Jesus was sentenced to death? The crowd, led by the chief priests, used what leverage with Pilate? Hey, he's claimed to be a king. You're no friend to Caesar if you don't take care of this man. So here at the end of Jesus' life is a reference to Caesar. Do you see that? At the beginning and the end are references to Caesar. Do you see that frame? Some people may say, well, how could there be any kind of significant history of the first century and not have a lot said about the Caesars? Well, the Caesars are there. But they're not the most important thing going on. Not in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John's biography of Jesus. The backdrop is that the Romans are there. And as you can see here, they had pervasive power from Rome to Bethlehem. And people, this Roman governor Pilate, was that leverage was used against him about Caesar. See how powerful Caesar is here? The idea. That's the framework. And you got to feel that power. You got to feel that power in the New Testament times that the Romans are there. You've heard the expression, somebody rules with an iron fist. Well, the Romans ruled with an iron fist that was slipped inside a steel glove, and on the knuckles were diamonds. That's how the Romans ruled. It's a mighty, mighty force. I made this point real quickly the other day, and we'll stop right there. But we'll start there next time. But it's so fascinating. It's at the time of the Romans, and the Roman Empire is now just budded into existence. More on that later. That the Messiah comes and brings his kingdom. That's when God chose the time. Okay, we'll start there next Wednesday and finish on Roman rule and start working our way into Jewish society.